Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
podcast while walking, just a general update on the practical projects that I'm looking at. So if you don't know, I'm doing overall rehab, sort of walking, memory exercises, hours a day, reading and memorizing things, slowly sharpening things up. And because you sort of, get into things, you're a bit fuzzy, and you start exploring things, you realize, oh, look, everyone else has been making these big errors. The thing to do is stop play. You can't really talk to people where you're a little bit fuzzy and they've made mistakes. It's a recipe for disaster. So what I've decided to do is break things up into practical projects, which I'll look at. And from previous, situations in which you've got a complex project to get, sort of critical path programming, you've got different paths going forward, and one comes to a halt, you can then pull resources off that and then put it on another one and sort of move things along. And so in this case, what I've decided to do is take on, the premium science experiments of our generations, which will be Einstein to Haas expect. I'll talk about that a bit. The other one is the Thomson waggly leg things. I think it was probably a bit rude what I've actually done. There's a sort of a whole series of ones, and you put it out there, and one of the things that you learn pretty much early on in project management, in that it's all ideal if you have control of the budget, the resources, but if you don't have it, there's sort of a second thing to do. So I think a lot of people who are trained in project management actually stuff it up. They just have temper tantrums if they can't have control, and they assume power has got to go, and so they identify a project, get people to connect to the project and go ahead. Well, this is at the other end of the spectrum, where you've got these a range of projects which you can move between, like the space project, which is the more practical one, the 1 trillion project. That's honed right down to the look at the feedback and just exactly what's necessary, and this one letter, I'll try and get to Rotary and work with it. So back onto the Einstein to Haas. So to put you in context, I don't know, been working hard, and for actually really rather neglected past while, I don't know, just doing things around the house, getting things done. What is it? I don't know. Just today I had a blood test, had to get lunch walk for my family, and then later on take my wife as she came back. I had to take her out, buy a present, come back, and I had to cook dinner. So it means at this stage I've got three. But during the day I got a shipment of my solid-state relay for the Einstein to Haas experiment. So let's look at this experiment. This experiment has a lump of iron in a magnetic field which flips up and down, and as it flips up and down, this gets this little pendulum moving. What could be simpler than that? Well, one of the things is that if the magnetic field simply flips, the iron feels nothing. It really should. If iron, and this is, I've got ferrite, which is basically iron with no current, so it's one step up, and it's sort of nice and cheap ferrites. So ferrites are the stuff for your fridge magnets. They're in your radios everywhere. They're little bits of, in terms of AC high-speed circuitry. They're the mass. Capacitors are the springs, and the ferrites are the mass to build your oscillations up. And in general, they don't really need them nowadays because of the sort of high-speed. But the actual signal processing is so high, you can go from high frequency down. Things like that. So the original ferrite I bought is sort of a legacy ferrite from a real crude piece of, it's like some sort of Neolithic stone compared to the modern high precision pieces of ferrite which I've bought. And look, they're only about, truly 20 cents each. You buy a packet of six for $1 or so, but not $6. So it's about 50 cents each. And these are precision, beautifully machined things. I would say micron tolerance, where it's been machined. And this is the fundamental thing of our day and age. Kids have toys, and they're really high precision. You open them up, and you might say, "My God, this is a micron tolerance molding," and because they just that's what they do. If you look at Lego bricks are phenomenally precise. Someone builds a tower of 300 Lego bricks, and the next Lego brick connects things meters across. This is incredible precision. You wouldn't be able to do this normally. This is all with injection molding and stuff like that. So indeed, injection molding, this type of stuff, has been used with these ferrite blocks. Polished, beautiful things. And I've used them as the ferrite. Now, so the idea is the field changes on, and the general thing is to rustle up a paper, start to get the research paper going. So I've got a bit of the research paper going, and you write a huge amount of stuff and it collapses to a sentence, and you pull things out, you write things and go, you're raving. And it's the research paper's coming along, and there's also such a thing as a concept prototype. You know that you are not in your home going to produce something that a research lab is going to produce. You can only produce something which teaches you. So the idea of a concept prototype is communication. One, it shows people what you're doing, and two, it teaches you, and indeed teaching me it has. And the critical thing is that you got a radially symmetric thing in a radially symmetric field, and begins to move, and it really shouldn't. And initially, when I thought of it, I said, "Oh, I'm going to get a microscope put up there." It wasn't necessary because this thing spins like the clappers, makes a complete monkey out of anyone who tries to put it together. And there's several things going on, because if you have a rotation thing suspended there, you automatically have got a couple of pendulums. It's got different modes. depending on how it's held, it can sway back to side, it can wobble side to side, and then it can spin. Now, if you have a spin mode in there, and it's wobbling from side to side, it's been tweaked around by the magnetic field a little bit, the stray magnetic field. So so essentially you make a joint north at the top, south down the bottom, by creating a south pole onto it, and it will feel the magnetic field, and there'll be a torsion like this, and this will begin to wobble. And so you've got all these couplings. So depending how you go, you'll get these couplings going on, and before you know it, you've got spinning, because spinning is the most obvious high value thing. You see it going, it's clearly not being excited by your magnetic field the way you want to. So there's things going on. And so essentially you go one direction of the mounting, and then improve it, reduce it, remove all the dipoles, and you can see it improve, and then you see it very much that it starts to couple. And one of the things is that you look at a solenoid, for instance, and a solenoid has got a minimum of field intensity right in its center. A long solenoid has a very flat minimum, a short solenoid has a very narrow minimum, and your little device is not going to be in the exact center, or it may spin and not be in the exact center, and depending on how you build it. And so it's going to be nightmare material. So one way is, well, I've got an unstable system, and if I wind up my I do one loop of my hand one solenoid incorrect, and building a solenoid is a bit of a task, because it's you can do all the calculations you want, but essentially it's the number of watts over the surface area, your voltage and stuff like that. And I think I've got 3.3 amps, 24 volts. That's, what is it, 75 watts of heat. So that's got to be put, if you put that in a little, bundle, that will heat up and fry. So you want to get maximum current, maximum field from, so you've got to think on it. Now, the issue here is that the design direction everyone has gone is building a better solenoid. Well, I unfortunately can't do that, because I simply don't have the money to build the next generation solenoid. I need to buy three rolls, $11 each. That's the dollars worth of copper and the time and labour to go in. I don't mind so much the time and labour, but you wind one and you get your therapy out of that. You sort of, your concentration and skill have to be very high. I'm going to quote some design techniques to get up there. That's your solenoid. So if people don't know, if I have a coil of wire and I put the current through it, that creates a magnetic field. I've forgotten what it is, NB, NA, something like that. I've really forgotten what the actual field intensity is. But it's the current across, and I think it may be scale independent, which is okay. It's just, obviously, if you get larger, you need a lot more wire to get there, and the resistance goes up and all this this palaver. So I suppose it's relatively good for me to strip off the enamel, to look at the handle, all the type of stuff, and start to build this sort of thing. But I've got this sort of concept stuff up there, and these sort of bad, and the worst. And so I started knocking off the worst and left with bad. And realization that you're on a hide into nothing building a solenoid, which is the intensities, most intense fields on the outside, and so your ferrite will seek that. And so unless it's heavy, you've got this fight between it being heavy and actually being drifting across. So the idea is that you could drift. It's sort of an unstable situation. So what you have to do, so what I'm doing is chuck that out, make a focused field line, so that just buy two solenoids from RS, your standard tap solenoid, $8 each, one top, one bottom, right at 24 volts, and I had a 24 volt power supply. You couldn't ask for more than that. But then there's a story about the electronics. I'm limited to 12 volts. But it's a concept prototype. Will get me in the right ballpark. So you've got a little thing, and then you've got your ferrite, which is hollow in the center. Bad and good. Bad because that ferrite, if it was all the way through, is pay dirt. You know, all the way through. That in the center, it's got no rotational inertia, but rotational kick from the electrons flipping up and down. So the Einstein de Haas experiment is you give something a little kick when you least expect it by changing the magnetic field in time. It's like rocking a key in the swing. You keep on pushing them in time, which is okay. And then you've got to say, well, why are we doing it? Well, it's your building. You're trying to build to suss out whether you can make an out-of-the-box Einstein de Haas. That is, Joe Bloggs in, I don't know, the Netherlands, let's say, or I can't remember, you know, whoever says, I want one. You've got to be able to put it in a box, ship it over to them. They switch it on and it auto-calibrates. Have you ever heard of something like that doing? A mobile phone, a drone, your TV set. Heaps and heaps of things do this. You know, your TV set, you switch it on, it sits down, works out the intensity and locks on to channel after channel after channel after channel. Does it auto-calibrate. And so we're living in an age now that what used to be a big... you've got to zero the magnetic field. And there's a reason you have to zero magnetic field, because you are making a compass which rocks, and the horror is that people said, oh, well, I can't control the coupling. And, of course, I think there is an advantage of being a molecular physicist here, because you know about couplings and curve crossings and resonances, and you know how to deal with it. However, the way that's been dealt with is, well, I'm going to build a huge solenoid. Well, I can't do that. I'm going to build a solenoid with the intensity in the center. So the thing has got stability in the center. It's not an unstable thing. I'm not trying to balance a marble on a gently curved inverted saucepan. Yeah, sorry, saucepan. Bowl, breakfast bowl, whatever. So you can do things like that. But zeroing magnetic field, piece of standard palaver. You've got Dreno board, a 3-axis magnetometer. Now the problem is that you look at the internet and you say, this has to be, you know, I can buy a drone with a magnetometer in it for $200. Now that means that it comes into the country. You go down, the magnetometer that they got there must at most be $3 or three. And so you should be able to get it for 30, not 300 or 900 euros. I don't know what there's someone there who's very valuable, very stuff like that, but you should be able to get one of those, whack it in with your Adreno board, zero it. And I mean, this is one advantage that I do have, is that I do know how to definitely zero things. I take a sweep and lab view it up, and so a lot of people try and zero things close to zero, whereas it's actually possibly better to zero things by looking at the symmetry, the side of it being mucked up, and you'll get a quadratic and fit the base of the quadratic far better. So if you can imagine, it's far easier to point using the edge of your quadratic rather than the base of your quadratic. We can get into that. So this sort of basic design here, which I'll troop along, and you've got to ask yourself, at what stage, you know, how fast can I get them? Now, well, the other thing is that you've got this very annoying click, 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 and your family going on, bloody hell, what are you doing? Oh, you can't do that, and all that negative stuff. And it's making this annoying click. And what's worse is that that click you hold a magnet or a piece of ferrite in the field, and you can, you can't, if it's held in the center, you can't feel anything except for this tiny twick where the field switches off, and you can feel it, and you think, that's 50 milliseconds, 100 milliseconds. If I go digital, I won't be able to feel it. You won't be able to do it at all. And indeed, that is true. So, digital, I know what to do. I will drive a digital switch. And that's where the story comes today. And I was supposed to get a package end of this month. And sort of like the whole thing, we're so efficient, we can't slow it down to our worst case nightmare. We can't, our worst is so good that a premium is probably not worth it. So I said, oh, I'll pay $11 for a 4 solid state relays. So I should be able to configure that, and got it online using PayPal, postage free. I'll go like that, and then of course it's going to take months going here. Of course, you can, for a package that big, you can possibly, it's going to cost you more to put a small package in a big shipping container and ship it out to Australia. And so what happens is it arrived, 3 weeks in advance, or 2 weeks in advance. Today opened up, and I was concerned that something from Hong Kong in a bang good package would, I have to explain, well, what's that? Is it sex toy, something like that? But no, it was from Thailand. And of course, people said, you're getting drugs! You know, package, and I opened it up, and it was so this, I opened it up, and then it sort of struck you. My goodness, a relay is big, but these solid-state relays are fairly thin and powerful. And I went to the process of putting it together. And what happens is, your brain really switches back on, and you remember that your crimping tool has wire strippers in it. I used to have a little handheld stripping tool. I love that stripping tool. It's so great. So I used that, and it eventually got up, and so I remembered how to do it, and was able to strip. And then there's the whole thing about, ideally, when you're putting a wire into one of those blocks, there's a crimp. Okay, there's this crimp tool. But firstly, you can, there's these numbering collars you put on things. So you just, as you put it in, you just number back and forth and wind it through, and it's all through, and you can just read the number off, and you crimp this little thing, and it slips in okay. Now, I obviously haven't got these crimp tools. Crimps, I don't know where these. And in fact, I've got power supplies and bits, and people should be using it, but they're not. So it looks okay. Everyone's done from the. So I've got an ex little power supply from a road monitoring station, which they built for a month, and then owned has changed, government's changed, and they scrapped the whole lot, the entire whole thing. Millions of dollars built from 1 month, and then said no toll, and so they just ripped all this stuff up and put some in the dumper and stuff like that. But even then, when you actually take this apart, you see these people, they're supposed to be electricians, but they're just getting some copper, stripping it off, and it's okay, and then they're screwing in, whereas, I don't know, from robotics, 98% of robotic failure, and it shouldn't surprise you, is cabling issues. And so there's all this cabling thing. So there's this sheet you put on things, and you say, and now, I've come from a long, long tradition. And when I say long tradition, goes back pre-World War II, to the radar guys, and, Dad would teach me how to plait wire. So they didn't have coaxial cables, but they wanted to have wires which didn't trip everything, and three wires or four wire ribbon, have ribbon wire, they've already got long wires, and so you'd learn how to plait it and put it across and various things, and, truly when they were just testing it, they would wind the wire up with your hand, your two bits of copper wire, and stretch the thread through there. So there's that. And then, of course, when I did my PhD, just a year before, they had gone through the entire place. So what people had been doing is that they'd been, with a piece of copper, putting it with a piece of solder, and the solder work hardens over time. So you've got a piece of vibrating equipment, which of course this isn't. The solder on your wire, which you put in your clamp, work hardens and fractures off, and it's brutal to do it. So coming up here, what do I do? I do the unthinkable, because I'm just whacking it together, have a look. I get my wire, which I don't know if I've saved from somewhere, and strip it down. This is a very heavy wire, heavy because you can just strip it in your big crimping tool. You can't do thin wire. You need your little, there's a little handheld, beautiful thing. Hook up wire, and it's so tempting to buy components and a breadboard and just stuff and have a play around. However, if it doesn't work, you haven't got the diagnostics to really work out what's going on. So it's a real dangerous thing. And for that, there's a beautiful wire tool. There's this fantastic tool with a gun with the roll in your hand, and you put it across the pin, it strips it, and then you go, and it just winds it around. And this, of course, this is yesteryear, because they've now got new things out, and I'm getting used to it. However, I solder that up now. This is 1 millimeter thing with solder. It's not going to fit in these Arduino boards, so what you do is you cop it, and then you get your pliers, and you squeeze it down. So you, I don't know what the thing of it, so you've got a round piece of solder, it's flexes, sort of soft, you squeeze it down, and it's sort of like the ideal plug, goes in neatly, screw it down, and so here I have it, and so what happened is that the Arduino thing is just like, how ridiculously easy to program is that? And so I programmed, when one goes low, the other goes high. And it's all of that relay. Well, the relay is an analog of my non-solid state, the physical relay. And what happens is that goes on, works perfectly on. And then that is, you put a voltmeter on it, and it goes 24 volts. Minus 24 volts, 24 volts, minus 24 volts. And then you hook it up to your coil, and it locks on 24 volts, or 0 volts, or minus 24 volts. And you go, what the heck? And you go along, and you start to open up, and you've got these things. You've got two types of solid state relay Oh my god, there's got zero crossing and random crossing. Random crossing is much closer, a solid state relay, which is built much closer to an actual relay. The solid state relay is, switch on and off when the zero is crossed. So it will keep on and complete the negative part of the cycle and then lock on, switch off, or vice versa. And you start to realize there's some people talking, oh, AC kickback and stuff like that. And you go, oh my, you know, and I'm reversing the, I can't put an overvoltage diode in this because I'm reversing the current on it. So if I put two diodes, the two diodes aren't going to work, aren't going to stop. And, capacitors, what the heck? And, zero crossing, I don't come across, and then I open up the, diagram. The wiring diagram, and, it's clearly incorrect from, Banggood. It's clearly, they call it zero crossing and the fire wire. What? Fire wire? You go up this complete chaos. And, the good thing is that, my soldering skill has improved and my general recollection of how to do things, precision of things, is very, very hard because you're, out on the deck with the wind and a failing light to get it all done. But it's going up there, and so you get it up, and so the great thing about these solid state boards is that LEDs cost nothing. The LEDs are basically almost painted on, and so you can see it switch on, and everything goes to plan. And you have this thing about, it's not working. Once I put a load on it, it doesn't reverse off. In fact, a solid state relay and a DC component is basically a recipe for a nightmare. And essentially a solid state relay really has to sit in between your load and supply in one particular direction, which is okay. However, if you're going to reverse it, it's almost topologically impossible to do it. And so back off, and then you say, what I really want is a DC motor control. And indeed, for $13, you can buy 2-amp, 12 volts. It's sort of sad. It's 24 watts per channel, so you might be able to. I might be able to get 50 watts of energy, magnetic field energy. But I'm going to focus it. So this is going to be an advantage, and it is a concept prototype. So I can't. And so I think this board costs $13, $18 by the time you put postage and stuff like that. And this thing's called an H-bridge, which is essentially a naked transistor, because this is essentially a solid-state relay is basically a high-end energy. It's not a transistor. It's not a triode. It's got four PNPN. PNPN, that's it. But you've got different roots of it, and over voltage, and you know, all this beautiful stuff in this little package, which makes you think. But again, it is a sophisticated beast out there for switching on lamps and heaters and household appliances. Not for controlling DC motors. Of course, that's what you want to do with your servo, and you you've got your two servos for an Arduino board. This much powers, it's unthinkable. This much, and it's basically a robot. And so I put in a order for that. I've got a mate's place. Go to the mate and pick it up quietly and just flush it through. So it's a bit of an opener. This beautiful, the lights, the other one with the physical relays, it's sort of click, but the lights goes on. This one, perfectly silent. Let's talk about the design consideration. When you make the iron Santa house, you don't have one. You have got, like a molecule, you've got all these different modes. You've got a rotation oscillation mode, you've got a sway mode, a wiggle mode. There's probably other modes. And each of these have a frequency. You've got to ask yourself, why have they selected a rotation frequency of once every 20 seconds? Like this. Why have they done it? Well, because they've sort of, I don't know whether they've done, I'm sure they are smarter than me, but it looks as though that they've said, okay, well, we're going to, a solenoid, if it's the better the quality of the solenoid is, the less of this, the less it's going to push the pendulum from side to side, then if there's transmagnetic field, it will tend to wobble, then I've got my rotation. Now the thing is that with a coupled pendulum, they do couple, but incredibly strongly if their frequencies are even remotely the same. So a coupled pendulum, if you've got two frequencies the same, it means that you get symmetric and anti-symmetric storage and transfer. And so what happens is that, and you can see it rotates, slops those down, starts to rotate again. And of course, always, quite obviously, it's a coupled pendulum. You've got coupling you want it. Now, the idea is that you should be able to pick the one that you want and ramp that up to high frequency. And so what I really would like is that, what was that the heck? My godfather. That is the biggest cicada I have ever seen. Sorry, mate. My God. That's a moth. Far out. Wow. Oh, okay. Now this moth, I mean, people would know, I mean, people bought moths like this in the school. This moth here, oh, it's not the size of a bird, is it? It's, I don't know what it's doing. It's a night moth. It's a pretty big beast, one of these moths. I don't know what's going on onto it. But I'll kind of tell you, there's nothing worse. You're in the bush at night and one of these things grab on it like this. Look, it's, if it was served on your plate as a sausage, you'd think, well, I have seen bigger sausages, but it's sort of that big there. Sorry about that at the moment. And I'll get back to it. So, if you can imagine, your worst nightmare is, you've got to, so you've got the strength of coupling between your modes. So if you've got something which is going to turn it, twist it, and then sort of hop from one mode to another, an unstable field, you've got nightmare material. So what you really want to do is get your rotation mode really high, really high speed up. So in 20 seconds, 0.2 seconds, that's 100 times greater time that you can pump into that mode. Now, of course, if your thing has got this little, I would venture to say that Einstein didn't have the solid state. He would have had some sort of mechanical switch clicking it. Okay, and if that click will send the vibration down, and that's got high frequency components, and you could sort of eliminate that. So I'm hoping that the so this is a DC motor control. Why not? Because DC motor is basically H-bridge on a chip, and you say, oh, I can build an H-chip, I need that transistor. Oh, it's got to take this, how does it get, you just, it's like the solenoid, it's all power engineering. So you can design all you like, but you've got to be aware that you're handling these large values. And you just go online, in stock, on the way to go. JK, you now know houses stuff 10 years out of date. Very convenient, nice to look at, nice service, things like that. It's sort of like, what the heck is going on with JCar? So, and you can order it. So that should enable me to effortlessly go to point two. And then that means I can put it on a stiffer rod. Ideally, I'd like to have an optical fiber go all the way down, because that's sort of the the torsion wire of preference. Quartz fiber is, there's people, just shut up, there's quartz fiber, it's got the greatest strength and rotation and stuff like that. And now you got something light, so the idea is that you have it, you shape the field that's okay, the frequency in, and now one of the worst nightmares I could possibly imagine is building your own driver for your laser module, your laser. You can buy these, yeah. Insanely powerful, you know, frequencies and powers. You just the stuff of dreams, and of course you want a little bit. But the bottom line is that there's Arduino laser modules, and I suppose I should have bought that in one go. But I've sort of just going to take some steps. There's no need to get a laser module to look at this. So the idea is that you have a little flat piece on it. Now, I'll just tell you a tip. Okay, so one of the things to do is to make the lightest flat surface imaginable is, and unfortunately I don't have Teflon, but you have a Teflon block and you get some epoxy. Put a tiny dab of epoxy, stick on a Teflon block, let it set, then remove it. Ideally, you couldn't ask for it. What's even better is a heat-cured epoxy. Just the tiniest dot on it, and it's stuck there. You don't need a mirror surface. That surface there is really shiny, a really good quality surface. You couldn't ask more, and it's incredibly lightweight, and it's not multiple reflections. It's just got everything going for it. So I sort of know what to do, get a laser thing, and if you can get high frequency, you can therefore look for the shape of your laser spot changing ever so much, and then image process that and really pick the bejesus out of it. So this, that is I don't know, ways of doing it. But yeah, so you want to get your oscillation mode high, and then if you imagine it's going at several hertz, and then the side to side, was if you make it a long thing, it's the side to side is necessarily long, and then moving from side to side, it's not going to be unstable. So what happens is that if you've got it in a stable section, so there's a whole lot of things pointing to the right direction, and the main thing is to get back into the saddle and get into that place and rearrange the objectives, so you're no longer building the thing, you're building a concept prototype in which you can start to make rational decisions to make it and say what am I aiming to do, and what I'm aiming to do is eventually get the sort of the core basis, with which is Arduino, and use the Arduino. Like, the Arduino may not be good enough to zero the field. What is, I don't know, because it's look, it is highly likely, because this is one of the things I used to specialize in, is getting pretty crap equipment and using fairly good maths to do it. So in the robotics that I used to position optics in internet photonic components, I'd have a pretty rough stepper motor system, the whole of shake in it and give, but by the algorithm where it would shoot, overshoot, and keep on tapping it back and forth, and working out where to go, it would get really spot on, better than, I suppose, the more, it takes a bit of time. Look, there are things that, thing is that I would say, an operator to position something by a robot, and they would do it with their hand, and what it would do is it would see the direction, take the vibration of their hand out, and map a spline fit to where they're going. So you can do all these things coming up. So, I'm reasonably confident that even that if the Arduino thing and the three axis thing doesn't work, I can actually pull it out to areas where it can and extrapolate in and lock it out. So I do think we can actually get there. Now, after sort of a shoot myself in the head time, my power supplies come in, which will allow me to power this up. I'll be able to put the road work power supply aside. The power supplies come in, and I'll start on the Thompson experiment. Got to go in, and what is really good is that I have spent, I don't know, possibly 2 hours working on this. But the 2 hours, well, okay, I've got to a point to very quickly, I had put all my faith in solid state. Solid state relays are completely different beasts from actual relays. We call them a relay. They have that function, they've got all these other functionalities in it, and so they've got to be used in a certain way. So they've got, so the H-bridge, so I've got that far, and the soldering, I was able to, but the first thing is horrible, second one is horrible, this one's a little bit of an improvement, but I should be able to get up there. And now, of course, it's all unnecessary. The actual solenoids hopefully will come in, and I'll be able to produce it. One of the things is that there's an alarm on this board which is coming in. It's beyond me. And you've got the board, and there's two stepper motor, it's two DC motor things to control, like, exquisitely, and analog feedbacks, and this is on the insane feedback aspect. So it's like delivering this stuff. They wanted to deliver it. They wanted to give it to me. They wanted it to take a month, so I go, oh, I might pay extra. But they can't help delivering it to high speed, and they can't help now that they've built in these circuits to high speed. And it's a bit of a head scratcher now, because you know all the components in there, but you know, all the components are now in the size of a pinhead, and the all surface mount. How do they put these surface mounts components that they isn't there's no they've got some holes through the there's a lot of things which are just not surface. They are surface mounts. I don't know how they solder it up. The pins are incredibly microscopically small. I do know that they do have an RF heating bath and put it in, but you know, this is astonishing. Their junk circuits, they're just pumping them. I don't know how much it costs them, because it's $8 now to get me this 4 relay. So I've got a family of relays. I wish I was teaching, because I've got an old relay, the new Arduino relay, solid state relays, which are functionally pure. Then I've got solid state relays, and they're just sort of like a nothing. And they're beautiful flat things coming up to give out all this heat. And they're pretty amazing little units. And of course, then what I actually want is this other thing, which is a factor of 10 times smaller and will actually do what I want. I just, unfortunately, I can't see there's a code. I can't see what is back and forth in the code, but obviously they'll be able to, it's an H-bridge, a DC thing, and an H-bridge is basically the relay equivalent. The H-bridge conceptually is the original relay that I was originally using it with. I'm about to head on back home. That's that process there, and it's rather good because I can focus on podcasts and getting the podcasts out. Writing out, that's horrible. And I just weep, and you know, I show friends my other papers, and there's this silent embarrassment that is just not sketch, but I have to start somewhere and push it. And similarly, it's really actually rather good. I've produced some work on the scale universe stuff, and the tendency is to actually put all these scales together, and it's rather good, because I have produced something which has put all the set of scales together in a usable format, and it's something that I definitely want to do. But as soon as someone doesn't understand it, they go shut down. And so at least if you could say I'm not trying to explain to anyone the Einstein to Haskell, except probably Sydney University. So the other thing which has come up is that there is interest from some chemists in UCS about making an Arduino 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 titration. Now, I've got this, I've got the general idea is that you want beakers which you can put something on top of and put something in it and it will squirt or drip the water, not at high pressure, into your experiment. And you've got sort of two ends. One is you can use gas to create pressure to push it out, or or you can build the unit itself, and you've just basically got your pH meter and you just want to feed the amount in and have a way of measuring what's in there. Now, the thing to me is that at some stage you've got to drive chemicals about the place. And it's hopefully small, much smaller chemicals about the place. And then once you've done it about, it's sort of similar to where I had to get glue and get glue moving around a factory. And the thing is that you can get a long tube, but the glue is inside the tube and the quality, it's just insane. Now, the problem is that if you use pressure, gas pressure is basically this enormous spring which can explode things and stuff like that. And if you use a peristaltic pump, it's a recipe for mechanical failure. So what I really want to do is get a beaker and have a balloon in the beaker, which seals, the balloon seals, expands with water, seals the beaker, okay, the pressure seals the beaker, and then the balloon continues to expand downwards. So what you do is you pump water into the balloon, the balloon presses down on your liquid, and pushes the liquid up through the, into your experiment. So you've only got a beaker, and so I want something which I put a drop of water into a balloon, and the drop of water in the balloon results in a drop of water, a drop of sulfuric acid or whatever it is coming out the other end. And at no end do I have a pump or pressure. You don't want to make a water pistol out of this type of stuff, but you could. And then after you built it, you either throw away the balloon or wash the balloon, or you've got your things to do with contaminants and stuff like that. But, ideally, you want something which, you got your chemical and it delivers it. So what I would like to do is, get your beaker. It has a tube down the bottom and, it puts on it and, then, you've got this generic thing. It's usually just got water and the water, is, well, I suppose it's not necessarily high pressure. The water, has to, what you ideally want to do is have, multiple valves. You can choose eight to go. Before that, it's got a valve in, a high pressure valve in, closes, and it's got that pressure, and then, and then it releases it, sort of a digital dropping, to go through. And, I don't know, you can have different ways of measuring it. And that way, I think you can go in, and so you basically have chemical A, B, C, D out there with these balloons which pop in, and the bottom line is, you may think this is crazy, but the bottom line is that I don't know how many, 40 inventions or something like that. I'm just trying to think of a basic parameter space. Like, you don't want air pressure pushing liquid. That is dangerous. That is a water pistol or something, whatever. That's dangerous. You want, and you don't want enormous pressures here. All you want to do is get a pressure of a few centimeters of mercury, which can actually push your component down. And so if you have something which, and it's ideal for sensors, you could have, and then the other thing is that, capacitive flow sensors, what more can you ask? You've got an empty tube with a foil on the outside of it, and it's capacitive. It's basically a fluid flows through a capacitive plate, and so this is ideal. So it fills, it goes in until the capacitive sensor says no, and then it, I don't know how you lock up the top, and then after that it continues to push down and push liquid through a tube, but very slowly. So I drop in, I drop out, drop in, drop out. There's nothing more like it, and I can sort of see how it can go. And you want a series of valves, and then this thing, well, I'm sure, this schoolyard chemicals, it's just the safest way to do it. So the large thing is, you don't want someone picking up a beaker of something caustic and pouring it over. You have eye protections, stuff like that. You just want it there, and you can actually drip it out. So I'll just run that past my mate John, who's picked it up as a tweaked on it, and we'll push that up, and I'll be coming back to my sleepy little house in the Blue Mountains, and I hope it's not so bad. So let's recap. There's nothing really, well, you can possibly heard if you listen to other ones where I've recalibrated, saying let's step back, and rather than actually try and do this as a contribution to science, do this as a semi-commercial exploration in which you're looking at it, refining what's going on, and then I'm actually going through the process of making mistake after mistake, but it's not catastrophic, because it's not so someone's focusing on me. I'm just making mistakes one at a time, sufficiently generally that I make a mistake, can correct it till the next time comes along. Thanks a lot for listening. I'll get this one off. Thanks for listening.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.